everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Media Voices podcast. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
But before we get started on the news, we have a little announcement to make. We've just launched the Media Podcast Awards, which is going to celebrate all the podcasts that publishers and media organisations are creating. So if you want to find out a bit more about that and the categories and when everything's opening, if you go to mediapodcastawards.com, or you can follow it on Media Pod Awards on Twitter.
Every time you say it, I do a nervous little giggle because I have to think about all the podcasts we have to listen to in order to judge this.
we're going to get some judges on board to help us, and we're going to be announcing some more about that in the next few weeks. But if you want to get involved, please do drop us a line.
And it'll definitely be fun. I'm really looking forward to it. It's something that we've wanted to do for a while. Yeah, exactly. But it's going to be, oh my God, it's going to be so much
it's
fun.
It's going to be a great night.
It'll be a great night. It'll be getting to the night this year. But the future of media is niche, and these are the most niche podcast awards in the world.
Ahead of the news, this week I spoke to Robin Vinter. She's the editor and founder of The Overtake, a North of England-based news site that was set up to cover, or to put a northern spin, on the sort of news that outlets based in the capital frequently miss. So we spoke about the importance of being independent, the strictures and sacrifices that come from being a small news outlet, and why there needs to be this variety and diversity of journalistic voices, particularly in 2019. Ahead of that, though, a relatively packed news roundup. To begin with, Twitter is putting content warnings over tweets from prominent public figures that break its rules. Esther, did you write AKA Trump?
Yeah, this is basically like Twitter's rule for dealing with Trump without kicking him off the platform, isn't it? I mean, I think probably it's because their team is sick of everybody reporting Trump's tweets. But this is the idea is that this will only kind of apply to tweets from accounts belonging to political figures, verified users, or like accounts with more than 100,000 followers. And the idea is that it's so that tweets can still be preserved as part of the public record without having them sort of go viral. It limits their reach a little bit. So I don't know if people have come across sensitive images on Twitter where you get like a grayed out box that says, this is a sensitive image. Do you want to see it?
I don't know whether that would work. That's got a morbid curiosity for me, that if I see something like this is sensitive, I'm immediately clicking on it.
And also that sentence, I don't know whether this will work in a conversation about Twitter, really. Jesus wept.
So what exactly is going to be covered by this? Because, you know, we were talking ahead of the podcast and I mentioned Jim Corr, the guy from The Cause, who's an anti-vaxxer, and he's been all over Twitter this week.
Is kind of he really?
Yeah, he's a massive anti-vaxxer.
I always hated them just for their music. Now I've got an even better reason to hate them.
It's just Jim, as far as I'm aware. Jim? I think it's just Jim. I think it's the one who's always forgotten.
Well, misinformation isn't covered by Twitter's... that's not a violation of Twitter's rules. You can tweet misinformation if you want. So misinformation, fake news and all that will still be fine. So I think there was an example...
Threatening to blow up a third world country.
stuff like that. So I think Trump had one where he was wrestling with the CNN logo, and that could technically be translated as a time.
God, I wish the CNN logo had kicked his ass.
That is bizarre. I've never heard that sentence before.
But whereas normally if you tweet something about beating somebody up, Twitter will just block you. It says, well, if Trump's doing it, actually that is kind of in the public interest for people to see that he's tweeting that. So we're just going to limit its reach and put it behind a warning.
Well, there is an argument though, isn't there? Because future historians need to know what a shit show we've been living through.
Yeah, it's interesting because you say it's going to preserve it in the public record. But if it's designed to limit the reach, then, you know, the public record won't include how many people might otherwise have shared it. You know, it'll be hard to gauge exactly how people responded to this.
Yeah. And it is also still that one rule for one rule for other people. And I mean, the statement that Twitter put out said that it almost suggested that they're not expecting to use it much at all. They said, you know, by their positions, these leaders have outsized influence.
But tiny hands.
And sometimes say things that could be considered controversial or invite debate and discussion. A critical function of our service is providing a place where people can openly and publicly respond to their leaders and hold them accountable.
Isn't this just a big PR job by Twitter, trying to pretend like they're doing something?
It's a little loophole, isn't it? It's
the babiest of baby steps. You know, this isn't going to solve a lot of the real problems that people genuinely have with Twitter. You know, if you look online, in fact, if you look on Twitter, it's littered with examples of Twitter sort of either hypocritically not enforcing the rules against somebody who's inciting hate, but then enforcing the rules against somebody who reports them. I don't know. This seems to be to kind of insulate themselves from some criticism around the bigger stuff, whereas the little stuff is still going unattended.
Well, if you call racism and misogyny little stuff, yeah.
Little issues like that.
Yeah.
And in other mad social media news, an Australian court judge has found that media organisations are liable for allegedly defamatory comments made by third parties on their public Facebook pages. This is madness. This is like King Canute trying to hold back the tide. How are you ever supposed to stop people on Facebook?
I read King Canute completely wrong.
Former Northern Territory youth detainee Dylan Voller sued three media organisations for defamation over a series of claims made about him in the comment sections of Facebook posts on the pages of the Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian, The Centralian Advocate, Sky News Australia and The Bolt Report. So, but what? How were they supposed to deal with that?
This is mental. We used this as a quote, I think, last week's newsletter. The story had just broken. And the guy from the guy representing News Corp Australia, was it? Was basically saying it's unsustainable. And he's right for once.
Isn't this just completely exculpatory for Facebook?
Well, easy for you to say.
But they can just say, well, it's not our responsibility. We're not a publisher. We're a platform. It's a responsibility of the publishers to moderate the comments that are made on our platform.
No, absolutely. They've been saying that for years.
Yeah.
But it's bullshit.
But I mean, okay. News Corp actually said that, didn't they? Because I think one of the statements they made is that it's ridiculous that the media company is held responsible while Facebook, which doesn't give them any ability to turn off comments or moderate them easily, really, has no responsibility. Where that falls down is that if the comment platform is owned by the publisher can put in place things like, a comment only goes up if somebody's seen it and approved it. There's no mechanism for that on Facebook at all. Australia could go to bed, wake up in the morning, and a defamatory comment has been up for 8 hours. There's no way of putting those into like a moderation queue. And so if Facebook doesn't give you the option to moderate before stuff goes up, you're still going to get caught by that.
So you can only take stuff down. You can't
retrospectively
stop
it
going up.
So exactly. How do you prove that you did it? You're going to have to say, look, here's the time between it going up and us deleting it. That's the only defense you've got.
Well, you just got to run a 24-hour moderation operation.
I mean, arguably, this is a result of people kind of devolving their comment section to the platforms. But this is bizarre. Like, even the Financial Times has trolls in its comment section. The FT.
All these people who make these comments have Facebook accounts. Why isn't he going after the people who've made the defamatory comments? I think it's like if a local council ends up getting sued because somebody writes abuse on a wall. It's that's not the council's problem. That's the person who's committed the crime is the person who's written something on the wall.
That makes sense. But, you know, so if I can be cynical for once.
What?
Isn't this just about the lawyers?
Yeah.
If you sue Joe Sixpack for making a defamatory comment, you're going to get dick all. Whereas if you sue the Sydney Morning Herald or News Corp, you'll maybe make more money.
Yeah, probably.
Is this not ultimately about human avarice and greed?
Yeah, exactly.
But if you sue Facebook, imagine how much more money you'd make.
Yeah, well, that's true.
It's bizarre. I mean, it's a dangerous precedent, and I'm very glad for kind of publications over on this side of the pond, whichever pond we're talking about.
Yeah, that's a funny. That's a different pond, man.
Completely different pond.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the things that's come out of the hearing is that they're taking this to appeals, and they are expected to be overturned in appeals just because it's so out of step with like every other sort of country that has laws like this.
Anyway, moving on then. A News Corp-owned tabloid is incentivizing journalists by paying cash bonuses in return for reader clicks, subscriptions, and page views. So I first saw this on The Drum, and there was quite a visceral reaction to this, wasn't there? I mean, people responded very negatively to it on Twitter.
Turn it off and on again.
So the Herald Sun is going to pay between $10 and $50 to journalists who hit specific targets, whether that's convincing a reader to subscribe after landing on a paywall story to exceeding a number of page views. And what's the problem with this then?
What do you mean by convincing the reader? That sounds like they're having like a full-on conversation. I wrote this really good story. Please subscribe.
I suppose it'll be that story was the first one that encouraged people to take that first step down the funnel to being a subscriber.
Can I play devil's avocado here?
Okay.
I don't get to do this very much. So if there's a big difference between driving for page views, which encourages clickbait and really crap quality content, and encouraging people to subscribe, which implies that you've actually written something that makes them want to pay out money. So
Absolutely.
why is it, I don't agree with the page views one, but why is it necessarily a bad thing to incentivize journalists to try and convince people to subscribe.
Okay, well, you're absolutely right about that. It's not. And in fact, places like The Times, The Telegraph, they allow their journalists already to see how many people have subscribed as a result of that story. There is absolutely nothing wrong with giving journalists the ability to see how many, you know, subscriptions they have driven. The problem is, as you've said, doing them both at the same time is a completely fucked up and illogical way of doing it that actually disincentivizes people to write those valuable stories and encourages them to write the kind of the trash, instant gratification stories that are contributing to some of the problems in the news ecosystem today.
It was Nick Thompson that was talking about this a couple of weeks ago with Wired, because they don't have cash incentives, but they've got people targeted and stuff. And he was saying actually that people get to the stage where they'd say, "Oh, I don't want to write that because it won't drive any subscriptions."
I think that's a problem with this coming down to us. If you get so granular, it's on one story. I think if you aggregate, it's not such a bad idea. You know, anything that bonuses journalists against the quality of content is a good thing. But where it becomes a problem is when you bring it right down to the individual story level, because the best journalist in the world is going to just try and, like you said, Chris, write whatever their version of clickbait is.
And the other thing that's difficult is that you get, in most newsrooms, you get people that split, you know, you've got some people focusing on news, some people on features. And like a really good in-depth feature will drive far more subscriptions than your news pieces, but that doesn't make them any more or less valuable.
But this has been going on for years.
Yeah.
This debate. And reading about this, I ended up down a rabbit hole back at a piece by David Carr, the late, great David Carr, Chris.
Yeah, I know.
He wrote this in 2014 when he was talking about a growing trend for compensation of journalists to be tied to traffic. What's brilliant about this story, as a slight aside, is there's a quote in there from Gawker's Nick Denton, remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Who was very bullish on the effect of new pay paradigms and said, "The journalists will do extremely well in the next 10 years. It will be a booming profession."
Yeah.
Oh, Nick.
That one goes in the in the Hall of Fame for bad predictions about journalism.
Oh, jeez, man.
My hand to God, we don't understand everything about how this is going to be done. Maybe it won't be done on a single story level. We don't understand the incentives or how they're going to be weighted. But it seems bizarre to me to have said we're going to encourage people to, you know, drive clicks in 2019 at a time when the industry should be moving away from that.
Well, I think the other thing that, because they did do a little bit into how their analytics platform was working that would that was going to drive this. One of the things they said about it is that they've enhanced their crime content with the launch of True Crime Australia, fine, because it zeroes in on more popular story streams such as entertainment, which tends to draw greater volumes of readers than dry political analysis.
Cool. Nobody needs political analysis in 2019.
Exactly. That's just that thing that story about Beyonce is always going to get more clicks than, you know, you're more local news features, but that doesn't make it any less important. And people just, analytics like this make you lose sight of that.
The solution to this is for Beyonce to run for president.
In Australia.
Well, as if any country is going to say, "No, Beyonce, we don't want you to be our leader." There's lots and lots of news in briefs this week. So to begin with, Quartz is shutting down its award-winning chatbot-style Quartz Brief mobile app. Which is kind of a shame. I thought this was an interesting experiment. It's obviously run its course, but, you know, it has. They are still continuing with their, you know, AI studio, which was effectively based around the idea of chatbots. So maybe just kind of ran its course. Who knows?
I think they're refocusing a lot of stuff. They've paid more people off, more commercial people, I think. And they've hired, like, a memberships editor. I think they're just refocusing a lot on the paid model.
Talking of not refocusing, the Evening Standard has reported a loss of almost £12 million this year. And it hasn't been in the black since 2006. I'm just trying to remember.
What happened?
What happened in 2017?
Oh, something happened. There was a change of personnel.
Wasn't it? Yeah. Anyway, I think...
These numbers are pretty austere, though.
Yeah.
I have to say.
But, you know, I think the story there sort of winds usually about how the ad-based revenue model isn't working, boo, Google, Facebook, da-da-da.
Yeah.
I mean, Metro, which has exactly the same model, seems to be doing just fine. So figure out
bizarre.
The common denominator.
It is a complete zone.
George Osborne.
Worky.
If you want to run a profitable newspaper business, you need to hire people who know what they're doing.
In other news about people not making very much money, Apple News Plus is disappointing some people.
What?
You surprised me.
One publisher has told Business Insider it's getting a 20th of what Apple promised. Another says it was on a par with what it was earning from Texture, which is not a lot, apparently.
So Bustle Digital Group has bought beauty, fashion and culture brand Nylon and is planning to relaunch special print editions around flagship cultural moments. So no longer doing sort of regular publishing schedule, but basing it around what they think will be the most important to their audience, which is fun.
Coachella, apparently.
Coachella, yeah, I can see it working there. But it's kind of similar to what, you know, say Monocle's doing with its summer print edition. Yeah. These kind of limited runs, I think, are a fun experiment. It would be interesting to see how they actually work out.
And LinkedIn is making changes to favour conversations that cater to niche professional interests rather than elevating viral content.
Thank Christ for that.
Thank goodness.
I'm so fed up seeing Richard Feakin Branson on my LinkedIn feed. I don't even follow him. Tinder and Cosmopolitan, two words I didn't think I'd ever use in the same sentence, have teamed up to launch a branded podcast about dating called Single, Swipe, Repeat, which, you know, as a kind of series of words, just embodies the absolute dystopian horror of modern dating.
Well, you say that, but it seems to be a take on the dystopian science fiction movie Live, Die, Repeat, so...
Exactly.
I'm not Tinder's biggest fan, so I'm actually just not...
Really? See, there's...
I think it's a bit like Weight Watchers in that they... The whole
Tinder's a bit like Weight Watchers.
The whole thing about it is that they're incentivizing you not to ever really settle down and find happiness.
The repeat part of that for me is the one that is like single swipe, repeat, single swipe, repeat, single swipe, kill yourself. It's just awful.
Well, you know, people like to play the field.
What's actually interesting about this is the branded podcast form. Yeah. I think that's brilliant. I love that. That's amazing. Yay.
Oh, it's almost like there's a branded content category at the Media Podcast Awards, yeah, isn't there?
That'd be cool.
Anybody else doing branded podcasts?
So journalists still use their peers rather than data to determine their audience. So this one completely fascinates me. I saw this on CGRs coming from the Tau Centre, and it's effectively saying that journalists, and particularly senior journalists, effectively still eyeball who their audience is based on their peer groups rather than using qualitative data, which actually goes a long way to explain why there is this disconnect between what the press thinks people are interested in and what people are actually interested in. And as a result, why we tend to get political journalism wrong so often.
Also, the whole diversity thing, it really flags that up.
Mm.
If you have a non-diverse newsroom, Jesus.
And more on podcasts, The Washington Post is launching a twice-a-week Spanish-language podcast.
Me robaron los zapatos.
Which makes sense, given that Spain is the country with the second-highest proportion of people listening to podcasts, according to the Digital News Report.
And we may as well end with podcasts. How many of the 706,000 podcasts out there are still in production? Answers on a postcard. No? 18%. 18% of those podcasts have actually added an episode in 3 months. That is lazy bullshit. That is some lazy, lazy bullshit.
I'm actually impressed it's that high.
How many episodes have we done?
107.
This is 107.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Good.
And if you think you're good too, don't forget that we have launched the Media Voices Podcast Awards, or rather the Media Podcast Awards, which is dedicated to rewarding those people publishing podcasts regularly, who think they have a product which genuinely adds value to themselves, their audiences, and ultimately their bottom lines. So you can follow us on @MediaPodAwards, or Esther, what's the website?
MediaPodcastAwards.com. Entries open in September.
Bing!
So don't forget, we have a transcript section on our website where you can read all our interviews thanks to a partnership with Trint. So just go to voices.media/transcripts.
This week, I spoke to Robin Vinter, the editor and founder of The Overtake, which is a north of England-based news site set up to cover or put a northern spin on the sort of news that outlets in the capital frequently miss. So we spoke about her personal journey from London back up to Leeds, why they employ people who have never worked in the capital, and the type of people that they actually employ, their plans for the future, and what it actually means to be an independent news outlet at a time when people tend to distrust the big media conglomerates. But I began by asking her about The Overtake's mission.
The Overtake is a news website for millennials. We try and focus on investigative journalism and the kind of stories that aren't well covered by the mainstream media. There are a lot of really good publications that do a lot of really good stuff for millennials, but often because they're quite London centric, they don't normally represent kind of the northern experience, or sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So that's the kind of thing that we focus on, generally speaking. Traffic obviously is a part of that, but we don't have any like programmatic ads or anything that kind of like directly is influenced by traffic. So when we kind of sell sponsored content, people are looking at our site stats rather than literally, you know, paying us per click, essentially.
So what would be one of those examples of a piece of investigative journalism you've done that you don't think would have garnered attention outside of kind of some very niche local areas?
We've probably done a mixture of stuff. We did something last year that was a long read where our chief reporter, Ethan Schoen, went on an illegal fox hunt with fox hunt saboteurs. So, he just kind of like followed the hunt around. And obviously, because he's a normal kind of looking guy, doesn't really look like a journalist. he kind of went under the radar a little bit. And that's done very well for us. We tend not to focus too much on traffic, you know, specifically traffic. But that one was quite widely shared. So that's quite a good example. To be honest, one of the most famous kind of well-known articles that we've done recently, which was longlisted for the Paul Foot Award, the Private Eye Paul Foot Award, was actually about London, which we don't normally do. But it was about racist door policies at London nightclubs, which I think if you ask any person of colour, it's not a very mind-blowing investigation because it's something that a lot of people have experienced. But it's something that hasn't been written about very much.
It seems like you almost preempted then the current push back towards long form, back towards writing stories that will really resonate with a particular audience.
You know, it felt stupid to be saying, no, I think people want long reads, especially because the kind of wisdom at the time was that young people especially don't want to read anything long. They want everything in tweet form. And, you know, they don't have a long attention span, which is the opposite of what we found.
Yeah.
So when, you know, if you look at the stats on The Overtake, the 18 to 24 demographic reads for the longest, and then each demographic it kind of tails off a little bit.
And on the site, on The Overtake site, you mention quite prominently that you're an independent outlet. So how important is that to yourself, to the journalists, and to the people who ultimately choose to support you, do you think?
I mean, to be honest with you, if a big company came along and gave us a load of money to just do our investigations, we'd probably suddenly find that being independent wasn't that important to us.
Fair enough.
I think this is what we wanted to do, and the independence allows us to do exactly what we want to do. It allows us to do investigations, allows us to kind of, you know, maybe decide that actually, we, instead of doing a load of events or we want to, you know, do this or do that, we want to channel everything we've got into an investigation. And there are two big investigations that we're working on at the moment.
Nice.
That probably a more, like a bigger company that's trying to scrape some profit out of it would not allow us to do. So in that sense, being independent is really important. We obviously, no media really is truly independent. Well, the money's got to come from somewhere. So it either comes from a massive backer, it comes from a trust, it comes from advertisers. So we're very careful about who we choose to work with, because ethically, we wouldn't feel comfortable putting some things on the site. And there have been times in the past where I've been approached to kind of write some sponsored content about something that I feel fundamentally is not good for you know, for our audience, and I've refused, which I don't know, it's always a bit of a balancing act trying to make sure you've got enough money coming in.
That's a brave decision.
It's really tricky.
Well, it's difficult. Yeah, holy shit.
Yeah, and you know, there's no prizes for, you know, for turning down an advertiser, really. Yeah, so it is tricky. And yeah, and it's finding a balance all the time. But yeah, I think for us, independence means that my entire team are the people that own the company, and it means we can do exactly what we want to do. And that's really refreshing, because, you know, you can have the freest job in journalism, but it's very rare that you can do exactly what you want to do.
I mean, you personally, you worked in London for a while, right, if I'm remembering correctly?
Mm, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what was the motivation then to move up to Leeds to kind of reestablish a base outside? I'm quite uncomfortable with the phrase the London bubble. I don't know what that means anymore, you know, but
yeah.
To outside of the capital where so much of the resources and so much of the attention on the press kind of sits.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is actually in London, there are a lot of journalists from outside London. Most journalists, I would say, are probably from outside London. Journalists from Yorkshire, which is where I live and where I'm from in London. But the problem is you have to a little bit buy into it, because you know you're going to be living there for a while, you know, or maybe your entire life. There's two things. If you're from the north, you obviously go to London with a bit of a perspective, or, you know, I say the north, but outside of London, actually, generally, you go into London with a bit of kind of outside perspective, but after a while it kind of dwindles. So I was in London for 6 years. I only ever kind of came back and visited, and I visited Leeds quite regularly because my family and friends are all here. I wasn't living here every day, and it wasn't just even simple things like how truly awful the public transport is up here. You know, I would get a train every now and again because I'd be coming back and visiting family, whereas and then the rest of the time I'd be in London, whereas now that I live here, I'm like, oh god, this is a real mess, you know. this is an absolute crisis. You mentioned that I lived in London, but actually none of my team are from down there worked in, yeah, so some freelancers have worked in kind of like the London media, the mainstream media, but none of my team have. They're all kind of northerners, and actually none of them have had a journalism job before, so for a lot of them this is their first job in journalism, and some of them are very young, so in their kind of very early 20s. So we've probably had nearly 100 kind of work experience people who come and we have internships where they come one day a week for a maximum of 15 weeks. Mm. And you'd be surprised how few are truly enthusiastic about actual journalism. A lot of them are kind of interested in writing or have a passion for blogging or opinion, but very few of them really have a kind of passion for finding stories and, you know, potentially doing some very, very boring work in order to get a good story out of it at the end. So recently we did an investigation where we looked into, which we've kind of just finished, where we looked into the Tory candidates' donations. Mm. And a lot of that was going through Companies House, going through LinkedIn, going through a lot of very boring reports to find out information about them. And there are very few young journalists who would be up for doing a lot of that, who, you know, spending a full day head buried in loads of really boring stuff, essentially, to find good stories. Ethan, who I mentioned before, who did the fox hunting article, who's our chief reporter, he doesn't have A-levels. He doesn't have A-levels, and he worked in manufacturing for like 5 years before he did this. But he's just a natural talent. Like, I don't know where he came from. I don't know why he's good at writing and has a passion for journalism, but he's just brilliant. So it just goes to show, if you look in the right places, and if you're kind of open to people from unconventional journalism backgrounds, you can get some real gems, definitely.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, arguably that's exactly what the industry needs, is people who don't have that kind of, you know, the Oxbridge upbringing that, you know, a lot of the people, particularly at the top of the newspapers, actually do. You know, definitely, there's definitely a place for that, but actually having a different perspective. You mentioned sponsored content before. Is that sort of the primary funding method that you use?
Yeah, sponsored content is the thing that we're focusing on the most at the moment. Hmm. I suppose, as a journalist, I have never been hugely focused on doing anything that monetizes the website, because I just have zero, you know, obviously we've got to pay bills, we've got to pay the team, and it isn't that difficult to make it work financially if you have the right people on board. And it's something that now I'm really having to focus on, because we kind of employ a good number of people. You know, there's been some months where I've been able to pay myself, some months I haven't. Goes up and down depending on what bills we've had and things like that. And sponsored content, I think, is a huge area that we can kind of grow into. So we've done a little bit already, and I've just taken on a couple of really good salespeople. That's been quite transformational for us, because previously we were an editorial team trying to do sponsored content. You've really got to lay it out on the table and show the brands exactly what they'll get from you. And, you know, previously I've been like, well, if they don't get it, you know, there's nothing I can do. And that's ridiculous, because obviously, you know, that's what sales is about. But we also do have our Patreon, which is an absolute lifeline. So, you know, for us, I think the lowest amount you can do is about 63p a week. That includes VAT. And it just kind of helps us know that we're going to be able to pay the bills. So we've got about, I think we've got about 85 Patreon people, or just over 85 Patreon people at the moment.
That's good.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's all been, well, most of it's been quite organic. Obviously, when you set up a Patreon page, you want a few people on there before you tell people about it. So there's a few friends and family in there. But generally speaking, you know, there'll be, every couple of days we'll get a email saying that we've got a new person. And I'll read the name to the team, and I always expect someone to be like, oh yeah, that's my uncle. But it's not, you know, often these people are kind of strangers to us, which is really exciting, because it means that people are noticing it and seeing the value in it without me having to ask directly for people to join. And then we do a tiny bit of syndicating content. I'm trying not to do it very much, because I feel like it devalues what, it devalues our site. If, you know, if we syndicate everything, it devalues what we do and what, you know, the reason for coming to us.
So, I mean, you're obviously hugely involved in the editorial side. You mentioned that that was your primary focus, and I presume it's still the thing that you're most excited about and interested in. So how do you actually find the time then to think about strategy and to think about where the Overtake might go next?
Yeah, it's really tricky, actually. I tend to rely a lot on the team. I'll often sit down with them and have meetings with them, and I'll say, look, where do we think we are going, you know, as a team? I don't think I would really, well, there's absolutely no way I would have been able to do any of this without them anyway, but I don't really think I could do too much of the strategy and too much of the direction of the company and where it's going without them, because you know, each person is just so vital to what we do. I have to say, I do quite a lot of long days, and, you know, sometimes when I want to do some, if there's some real reporting that I want to do, I'll sometimes clear the weekend so that I can do that, which isn't ideal. I'm trying not to do it as much, because it's really, really bad for your mental health to do constantly doing long days and then still sometimes doing weekends. But, you know, the one that was long listed for the Paul Foot Award, the Racism in London Nightclubs piece, that I did over a weekend. You know, I got the idea for it on the Friday, did all the research and the work, and then published it on the Sunday. And, you know, sometimes it's just necessary to do it like that. I don't want to, but to do something like this without any, you know, without any investment or without somebody coming along with a big wad of cash and saying, do whatever you want, you've got to make a lot of sacrifices. And, you know, a lot of it is time and sometimes mental health as well.
Yeah. So what then, given all that, and given that it is a very, you know, there's a lot of hardships almost that you have to overcome there, what does a good week look like for the Overtake? Is it, you know, we brought in X number of subscribers? Is it we managed to publish something that we think is really going to shift public thinking on this? You know, is it effectively the same as for any news outlet, or is there more specific things for you?
No, I think that's about right, actually. I would say people often ask, like, what are your KPIs? And obviously I understand the need for some kind of metrics to understand how well you're doing. But I think, are the team happy? Do people feel like they're working on something that nobody sees? Or do they feel like they're overworked? Or, you know, they're always going to feel like they're underpaid, or at least in the immediate future. But so, number one, are the team happy? Number two, are we doing stuff that we can really be proud of? So, you know, every now and again, someone will do an article that just blows up. So we had a piece that was about the ethics of burying people. Instead of cremating.
Really? That's fascinating.
So we published that, was it last week, I think? And that was written by Samira Ahmed, she's just turned 19, but I think she was 18 when she wrote that piece. Again, another absolute gem. Don't know how we found her, but she's exceptional. So we published it maybe last week I think it was. And it's one of our most read articles, like just inexplicably. It's a great piece, but we do lots of great pieces that don't do, you know, nearly as well as that. So I don't let my team look at traffic at all because I just don't want them to get hung up on that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's just no good for anyone. It's not good for you. Like, I'll obviously look at traffic and, you know, just make sure that we're kind of slowly, I guess, growing.
Yeah.
But I don't want them to do an article that they put their absolute heart and soul into that's exceptional, and then people just for some reason don't notice it, or it doesn't get picked up, or, you know, it doesn't go on the front page of a news app. I don't want to put my team through that unnecessarily. I want them to understand the value of the journalism that they do, not, you know, the number of people that read it.
So what can Media Voices listeners do to support either The Overtake or maybe other outlets like it?
The thing is, we get a lot of really good advice from people. So it might be as simple as, oh, your website should show more articles. You know, I should be able to scroll back for, you know, 3 months worth of articles, which is great. But there's nothing we can do about that until we get more money in so that we can pay someone to fix that problem. So there's a lot of people feel like they're being very helpful by giving advice. And like, I will always welcome advice. But essentially, it's more about donating a little bit of your time if you're able to do so, or a little bit of your expertise to be able to help out. And then obviously, like I say, the money is a huge thing. So, you know, small publications just really, really don't have the same kind of clout as big publications. You know, at the end of the day, everybody likes the idea of independent media existing alongside things like the Daily Mail. But not everybody likes the idea of contributing financially to it, which I do understand. And not everybody's in a position to do so. But they don't exist without donations, and they don't exist without people helping out. So whether people can contribute a bit of time or whether they can contribute a bit of money, it makes the world a difference. And actually, just sometimes people getting in touch with me and saying, oh, I noticed your SEO isn't very good. I can do these things for you to help out. That makes the world a difference compared to somebody saying you should do these things, because I'm at absolute capacity at the moment. We don't have any spare cash to like invest in improving the website or improving different things. And actually, you know, there's a lot of things I could do if I had the time, or, you know, that I could learn about if I had the time, but you know, we're just absolutely stretched at the moment. So even just somebody who says, oh, I've got a free afternoon on a Thursday, I can pop in for an hour or so and, you know, help you with this. It's absolutely transformative.
And then just as a final question then, because we ask all our guests, what was the last piece of media that you read, watched, listened to, anything that you really, really loved and would really love to, or, you know, had an emotional response to for any reason that you would really like to suggest that our listeners seek out?
Okay, yes. So I'm actually not really answering the question at all because I wanted to kind of flag up something called Journo Resources, which is it's run by Jem Collins, who's a journalist, and it's all about kind of leveling the playing field for people wanting to get into journalism. So rather than relying on like an old boys network, it's giving people kind of tools and resources to help them learn about journalism and get into journalism. So there are articles on, they've got a website, and there are articles on there about pitching, about the day in the life of different journalists. And it's kind of the ethos of it is about getting people from underrepresented backgrounds into journalism. And there are a lot, you know, there are a lot of different things that are really great that are helping that in different ways. So there's another thing called PressPad, which is having somewhere for people to stay if they don't know anyone in London, or if they don't have a load of money, that they can just kind of get a hotel or, you know, rent somewhere. It's allowing people to stay in London so that they can do an internship, an unpaid internship or something like that. Those kind of resources are absolutely valuable. And again, they're all having the same problem that we're having. They need a certain amount of money a month to kind of keep going and to pay the team. And I know Jem pays very fairly. But yes, Journo Resources, it's such a valuable thing. And I really hope that people listen to this and go on the General Resources website, have a look at what they do, because everyone will agree that it's really valuable.
Can I just say, right, Chris?
Yeah.
Just play a little 3-chord progression. Did you know we have a newsletter? And you really need to sign up for it. Because if you don't, we're going to sing this song every fucking episode at the end.
That's beautiful.
That was amazing. And I can't top that. I just can't top that. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we are at Media Voices Pod. Or if you now want to follow the podcast awards, you can follow at Media Pod Awards. That's a lot of following to do, but follow. Please, thank you.
Don't forget, you can also check out everything we've ever published and more besides by going to the website, which is voices.media. Until next week, when we're going to be back with another absolutely fantastic guest, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Stop Brexit!
I think the heat got to us.
Yeah, thanks.